Chapter 6. When I was a small boy at school, a lecturer used to come once a term and deliver excellent lectures on famous battles of the past, such as Blenheim, Austerlitz, etc. He was fond of quoting Napoleon's maxim, "An army marches on its stomach," and at the end of his lecture he would suddenly turn to us and demand, "What's the most important thing in the world?" We were expected to shout, "Food." And if we did not do so, he was disappointed. Obviously, he was right in a way. A human being is primarily a bag for putting food into. The other functions and faculties may be more godlike, but in point of time they come afterwards. A man dies and is buried, and all his words and actions are forgotten, but the food he has eaten lives after him in the sound or rotten bones of his children. I think it could be plausibly argued that changes of diet are more important than changes of dynasty or even of religion. The Great War, for instance, could never have happened if tinned food had not been invented. And the history of the past 400 years in England would have been immensely different if it had not been for the introduction of root crops and various other vegetables at the end of the Middle Ages. And a little later, the introduction of non-alcoholic drinks, tea, coffee, cocoa, and also of distilled liquors, to which the beer-drinking English were not accustomed. Yet it is curious how seldom the all-importance of food is recognized. You see statues everywhere to politicians, poets, bishops, but none to cooks or bacon curers or market gardeners. The Emperor Charles V is said to have erected a statue to the inventor of bloaters, but that is the only case I can think of at the moment. So perhaps the really important thing about the unemployed, the really basic thing if you look to the future, is the diet they are living on. As I said earlier, the average unemployed family lives on an income of round about 30 shillings a week, of which at least a quarter goes in rent. It is worth considering in some detail how the remaining money is spent. I have here a budget which was made out for me by an unemployed miner and his wife. I asked them to make a list which represented as exactly as possible their expenditure in a typical week. This man's allowance was 32 shillings a week, and besides his wife he had two children, one aged 2 years and 5 months and the other 10 months. Here is the list. S. D. Rent. 9. 0. 1 half. Clothing club. 3. 0. Coal. 2. 0. Gas. 1. 3. Milk. 0. 10. 1 half. Union fees. 0. 3. Insurance, on the children. 0. 2. Meat. 2. 6. Flour, 2 stone. 3. 4. Yeast. 0. 4. Potatoes. 1. 0. Dripping. 0. 10. Margarine. 0. 10. Bacon. 1. 2. Sugar. 1. 9. Tea. 1. 0. Jam. 0. 7. 1 half. Peas and cabbage. 0. 6. Carrots and onions. 0. 4. Quaker oats. 0. 4. 1 half. Soap. Powders, blue, etc. 0. 10. Total. 1 pound. 12. 0. In addition to this, 3 packets of dried milk were supplied weekly for the baby by the infant's welfare clinic. 1 or 2 comments are needed here. To begin with, the list leaves out a great deal: blacking, pepper, salt, vinegar, matches, kindling wood, razor blades, replacements of utensils and wear and tear of furniture and bedding, to name the first few that come to mind. Any money spent on these would mean reduction on some other item. A more serious charge is tobacco. This man happened to be a small smoker, but even so his tobacco would hardly cost less than a shilling a week, meaning a further reduction on food. The clothing clubs into which unemployed people pay so much a week are run by big drapers in all the industrial towns. Without them it would be impossible for unemployed people to buy new clothes at all. I don't know whether or not they buy bedding through these clubs. This particular family, as I happen to know, possessed next to no bedding. In the above list, if you allow a shilling for tobacco and deduct this and the other non-food items, you are left with 16 and 5 pence halfpenny. Call it 16 shillings and leave the baby out of account, for the baby was getting its weekly packets of milk from the welfare clinic. This 16 shillings has got to provide the entire nourishment, including fuel, of 3 persons, 2 of them adult. The first question is whether it is even theoretically possible for 3 persons to be properly nourished on 16 shillings a week. When the dispute over the means test was in progress, there was a disgusting public wrangle about the minimum weekly sum on which a human being could keep alive. So far as I remember, one school of dietitians worked it out at 5 and 9 pence, while another school, more generous, put it at 5 and 9 pence halfpenny. After this there were letters to the papers from a number of people who claimed to be feeding themselves on 4 shillings a week. Here is a weekly budget, it was printed in the New Statesman and also in the News of the World, which I picked out from among a number of others. S. D. 3 wholemeal loaves. 1. 0. Half a pound. Margarine. 0. 2. 1 half. Half a pound, dripping. 0. 3. 1 pound, cheese. 0. 7. 1 pound, onions. 0. 1. 1 half. 1 pound, carrots. 0. 1. 1 half. 1 pound, broken biscuits. 0. 4. 2 pounds. Dates. 0. 6. 1 tin evaporated milk. 0. 5. 10 oranges. 0. 5. Total. 3. 11. 1 half. Please notice that this budget contains nothing for fuel. In fact, the writer explicitly stated that he could not afford to buy fuel and ate all his food raw. Whether the letter was genuine or a hoax does not matter at the moment. What I think will be admitted is that this list represents about as wise an expenditure as could be contrived. If you had to live on 3 and 11 pence halfpenny a week, you could hardly extract more food value from it than that. So perhaps it is possible to feed yourself adequately on the pack allowance if you concentrate on essential foodstuffs, but not otherwise. Now compare this list with the unemployed miner's budget that I gave earlier. The miner's family spend only 10 pence a week on green vegetables and 10 pence halfpenny on milk, remember that one of them is a child less than 3 years old, and nothing on fruit. But they spend 1 and 9 on sugar, about 8 pounds of sugar, that is, and a shilling on tea. The half crown spent on meat might represent a small joint and the materials for a stew. Probably as often as not it would represent 4 or 5 tins of bully beef. The basis of their diet, therefore, is white bread and margarine, corned beef, sugared tea and potatoes, an appalling diet. Would it not be better if they spent more money on wholesome things like oranges and wholemeal bread, or if they even, like the writer of the letter to the New Statesman, saved on fuel and ate their carrots raw? Yes, it would, but the point is that no ordinary human being is ever going to do such a thing. The ordinary human being would sooner starve than live on brown bread and raw carrots. And the peculiar evil is this, that the less money you have, the less inclined you feel to spend it on wholesome food. A millionaire may enjoy breakfasting off orange juice and Revita biscuits, an unemployed man doesn't. Here the tendency of which I spoke at the end of the last chapter comes into play. When you are unemployed, which is to say when you are underfed, harassed, bored and miserable, you don't want to eat dull wholesome food. You want something a little bit tasty. There is always some cheaply pleasant thing to tempt you. Let's have 3 pennyworth of chips. Run out and buy us a 2-penny ice cream. Put the kettle on and we'll all have a nice cup of tea. That is how your mind works when you are at the pack level. White bread and marg and sugar tea don't nourish you to any extent, but they are nicer, at least most people think so, than brown bread and dripping in cold water. Unemployment is an endless misery that has got to be constantly palliated, and especially with tea, the Englishman's opium. A cup of tea or even an aspirin is much better as a temporary stimulant than a crust of brown bread. The results of all this are visible in a physical degeneracy which you can study directly, by using your eyes, or inferentially, by having a look at the vital statistics. The physical average in the industrial towns is terribly low, lower even than in London. In Sheffield you have the feeling of walking among a population of troglodytes. The miners are splendid men, but they are usually small, and the mere fact that their muscles are toughened by constant work does not mean that their children start life with a better physique. In any case, the miners are physically the pick of the population. The most obvious sign of undernourishment is the badness of everybody's teeth. In Lancashire you would have to look for a long time before you saw a working-class person with good natural teeth. Indeed, you see very few people with natural teeth at all, apart from the children. And even the children's teeth have a frail bluish appearance which means, I suppose, calcium deficiency. Several dentists have told me that in industrial districts a person over 30 with any of his or her own teeth is coming to be an abnormality. In Wigan various people gave me their opinion that it is best to get shut of your teeth as early in life as possible. Teeth is just a misery, one woman said to me. In one house where I stayed there were, apart from myself, 5 people, the oldest being 43 and the youngest a boy of 15. Of these the boy was the only one who possessed a single tooth of his own, and his teeth were obviously not going to last long. As for the vital statistics. The fact that in any large industrial town the death rate and infant mortality rate of the poorest quarters are always about double those of the well-to-do residential quarters, a good deal more than double in some cases, hardly needs commenting on. Of course one ought not to imagine that the prevailing bad physique is due solely to unemployment, for it is probable that the physical average has been declining all over England for a long time past. And not merely among the unemployed in the industrial areas. This cannot be proved statistically, but it is a conclusion that is forced upon you if you use your eyes, even in rural places and even in a prosperous town like London. On the day when King George V's body passed through London on its way to Westminster, I happened to be caught for an hour or two in the crowd in Trafalgar Square. It was impossible, looking about one then, not to be struck by the physical degeneracy of modern England. The people surrounding me were not working-class people for the most part. They were the shopkeeper commercial traveller type, with a sprinkling of the well-to-do. But what a set they looked! Puny limbs, sickly faces, under the weeping London sky. Hardly a well-built man or a decent-looking woman, and not a fresh complexion anywhere. As the king's coffin went by, the men took off their hats, and a friend who was in the crowd at the other side of the Strand said to me afterwards, the only touch of colour anywhere was the bald heads. Even the guards, it seemed to me, there was a squad of guardsmen marching beside the coffin, were not what they used to be. Where are the monstrous men with chests like barrels and mustaches like the wings of eagles who strode across my childhood's gaze 20 or 30 years ago? Buried, I suppose, in the Flanders mud. In their place there are these pale-faced boys who have been picked for their height and consequently look like hop poles in overcoats, the truth being that in modern England a man over 6 feet high is usually skin and bone and not much else. If the English physique has declined, this is no doubt partly due to the fact that the Great War carefully selected the 1,000,000 best men in England and slaughtered them, largely before they had had time to breed. But the process must have begun earlier than that, and it must be due ultimately to unhealthy ways of living, i.e. to industrialism. I don't mean the habit of living in towns, probably the town is healthier than the country, in many ways, but the modern industrial technique which provides you with cheap substitutes for everything. We may find in the long run that tinned food is a deadlier weapon than the machine gun. It is unfortunate that the English working class, the English nation generally, for that matter, are exceptionally ignorant about and wasteful of food. I have pointed out elsewhere how civilized is a French navvy's idea of a meal compared with an Englishman's, and I cannot believe that you would ever see such wastage in a French house as you habitually see in English ones. Of course, in the very poorest homes, where everybody is unemployed, you don't see much actual waste, but those who can afford to waste food often do so. I could give startling instances of this. Even the northern habit of baking one's own bread is slightly wasteful in itself, because an overworked woman cannot bake more than once or, at most, twice a week, and it is impossible to tell beforehand how much bread will be wanted. So that a certain amount generally has to be thrown away. The usual thing is to bake 6 large loaves and 12 small ones at a time. All this is part of the old, generous English attitude to life, and it is an amiable quality, but a disastrous one at the present moment. English working people everywhere, so far as I know, refuse brown bread. It is usually impossible to buy wholemeal bread in a working-class district. They sometimes give the reason that brown bread is dirty. I suspect the real reason is that in the past brown bread has been confused with black bread, which is traditionally associated with popery and wooden shoes. They have plenty of popery and wooden shoes in Lancashire. A pity they haven't the black bread as well. But the English palate, especially the working-class palate, now rejects good food almost automatically. The number of people who prefer tinned peas and tinned fish to real peas and real fish must be increasing every year. And plenty of people who could afford real milk in their tea would much sooner have tinned milk, even that dreadful tinned milk which is made of sugar and corn flour and has "unfit for babies" on the tin in huge letters. In some districts, efforts are now being made to teach the unemployed more about food values and more about the intelligent spending of money. When you hear of a thing like this, you feel yourself torn both ways. I have heard a communist speaker on the platform grow very angry about it. In London, he said, parties of society dames now have the cheek to walk into East End houses and give shopping lessons to the wives of the unemployed. He gave this as an instance of the mentality of the English governing class. First you condemn a family to live on 30 shillings a week, and then you have the damned impertinence to tell them how they are to spend their money. He was quite right, I agree heartily. Yet all the same, it is a pity that, merely for the lack of a proper tradition, people should pour muck like tinned milk down their throats and not even know that it is inferior to the product of the cow. I doubt, however, whether the unemployed would ultimately benefit if they learned to spend their money more economically. For it is only the fact that they are not economical that keeps their allowances so high. An Englishman on the pack gets 15 shillings a week because 15 shillings is the smallest sum on which he can conceivably keep alive. If he were, say, an Indian or Japanese coolie, who can live on rice and onions, he wouldn't get 15 shillings a week. He would be lucky if he got 15 shillings a month. Our unemployment allowances, miserable though they are framed to suit a population with very high standards and not much notion of economy. If the unemployed learned to be better managers, they would be visibly better off, and I fancy it would not be long before the dole was docked correspondingly. There is one great mitigation of unemployment in the North, and that is the cheapness of fuel. Anywhere in the coal areas the retail price of coal is about 1 6 pence a hundredweight, in the south of England it is about half a crown. Moreover, miners in work can usually buy coal direct from the pit at 8 or 9 shillings a ton, and those who have a cellar in their homes sometimes store a ton at a time and sell it, illicitly, I suppose, to those who are out of work. But apart from this, there is immense and systematic thieving of coal by the unemployed. I call it thieving because technically it is that, though it does no harm to anybody. In the dirt that is sent up from the pits there is a certain amount of broken coal, and unemployed people spend a lot of time in picking it out of the slag heaps. All day long over those strange grey mountains you see people wandering to and fro with sacks and baskets among the sulfurous smoke. Many slag heaps are on fire under the surface, prizing out the tiny nuggets of coal which are buried here and there. You meet men coming away, wheeling strange and wonderful homemade bicycles, bicycles made of rusty parts picked off refuse tips, without saddles. Without chains and almost always without tires, across which are slung bags containing perhaps half a hundredweight of coal, fruit of half a day's searching. In times of strikes, when everybody is short of fuel, the miners turn out with pick and shovel and burrow into the slag heaps, whence the hummocky appearance which most slag heaps have. During long strikes, in places where there are outcrops of coal, they have sunk surface mines and carried them scores of yards into the earth. In Wigan the competition among unemployed people for the waste coal has become so fierce that it has led to an extraordinary custom called scrambling for the coal, which is well worth seeing. Indeed, I rather wonder that it has never been filmed. An unemployed miner took me to see it one afternoon. We got to the place, a mountain range of ancient slag heaps with a railway running through the valley below. A couple of hundred ragged men, each with a sack and coal hammer strapped under his coat tails, were waiting on the brew. When the dirt comes up from the pit it is loaded onto trucks and an engine runs these to the top of another slag heap a quarter of a mile away and there leaves them. The process of scrambling for the coal consists in getting onto the train while it is moving. Any truck which you have succeeded in boarding while it is in motion counts as your truck. Presently the train hove in sight. With a wild yell, 100 men dashed down the slope to catch her as she rounded the bend. Even at the bend the train was making 20 miles an hour. The men hurled themselves upon it, caught hold of the rings at the rear of the trucks and hoisted themselves up by way of the bumpers, 5 or 10 of them on each truck. The driver took no notice. He drove up to the top of the slag heap, uncoupled the trucks and ran the engine back to the pit, presently returning with a fresh string of trucks. There was the same wild rush of ragged figures as before. In the end only about 50 men had failed to get onto either train. We walked up to the top of the slag heap. The men were shoveling the dirt out of the trucks, while down below their wives and children were kneeling, swiftly scrabbling with their hands in the damp dirt and picking out lumps of coal the size of an egg or smaller. You would see a woman pounce on a tiny fragment of stuff, wipe it on her apron, scrutinize it to make sure it was coal and pop it jealously into her sack. Of course, when you are boarding a truck you don't know beforehand what is in it. It may be actual dirt from the roads or it may merely be shale from the roofing. If it is a shale truck there will be no coal in it, but there occurs among the shale another inflammable rock called cannel, which looks very like ordinary shale but is slightly darker and is known by splitting in parallel lines, like slate. It makes tolerable fuel, not good enough to be commercially valuable but good enough to be eagerly sought after by the unemployed. The miners on the shale trucks were picking out the cannel and splitting it up with their hammers. Down at the bottom of the brew, the people who had failed to get onto either train were gleaning the tiny chips of coal that came rolling down from above, fragments no bigger than a hazelnut, these, but the people were glad enough to get them. We stayed there till the train was empty. In a couple of hours the people had picked the dirt over to the last grain. They slung their sacks over shoulder or bicycle, and started on the 2-mile trudge back to Wigan. Most of the families had gathered about half a hundredweight of coal or cannel, so that between them they must have stolen 5 or 10 tons of fuel. This business of robbing the dirt trains takes place every day in Wigan, at any rate in winter, and at more collieries than one. It is of course extremely dangerous. No one was hurt the afternoon I was there, but a man had had both his legs cut off a few weeks earlier, and another man lost several fingers a week later. Technically it is stealing but, as everybody knows, if the coal were not stolen it would simply be wasted. Now and again, for form's sake, the colliery companies prosecute somebody for coal picking, and in that morning's issue of the local paper there was a paragraph saying that 2 men had been fined 10 shillings. But no notice is taken of the prosecutions. In fact, one of the men named in the paper was there that afternoon, and the coal pickers subscribe among themselves to pay the fines. The thing is taken for granted. Everyone knows that the unemployed have got to get fuel somehow. So every afternoon several hundred men risk their necks and several hundred women scrabble in the mud for hours, and all for half a hundredweight of inferior fuel, value 9p. That scene stays in my mind as one of my pictures of Lancashire, the dumpy, shawled women, with their sacking aprons and their heavy black clogs, kneeling in the cindery mud and the bitter wind, searching eagerly for tiny chips of coal. They are glad enough to do it. In winter they are desperate for fuel, it is more important almost than food. Meanwhile all round, as far as the eye can see, are the slag heaps and hoisting gear of collieries, and not one of those collieries can sell all the coal it is capable of producing. This ought to appeal to Major Douglas.